This is the speaker you all been waiting for. The last one. I'm delighted to see you. I'm Tom Ivester, an alcoholic. And really has been a pleasure to be here. And Mike's right. We've had a grand time. When we met out at the airport, it's been a weekend for disorganization, I think, because getting the baggage took longer than the flight. We just stood out there and made a career out of waiting on suitcases. And then we started trying to agree on what we're going to do. And I put top of the list is I don't want to go to Six Flags. And I mean, nothing against it, but that ain't what I came for. I said, well, I'll just get me in the middle of a bunch of AA folks and let's just talk drunk stuff for the next 3 days. And so that's what we've done. We've had a great time. It's been a bit of an eating orgy because in addition to Mike, Pat Wheeler was our role model for the eating. What an order. We couldn't go through with that. That's been great fun. It really, really has been a good weekend. I've appreciated it. I agree with Mike. This has probably been one of the most powerful lineups of speakers that I've been associated with for many, many years. It's just been outstanding. A bit unusual in design, because I'm not sure if the program chair had a method in putting the lineup together. But if you think about it, about who we are as a cast of characters, we had two lawyers, and then between them, the drums, and me. Now, if there's ever been a lineup needed lawyers at either end, it's us. We had a few problems over at the hotel. I always had problems at hotels. They always wanted to throw me out. I thought they'd quit, but they still had it. And I was just smart enough to get out of the way and let Francine go in and do all the fighting. I figured that's what lawyers do. And, and she got us in. This morning she's in the process of getting us out, I think. So, now it really has been a good lineup. And I have thoroughly, thoroughly appreciated the weekend. I'm going to see if I can take his watch off. Probably doesn't mean one single thing. Yeah, it does too. I'm bad about not remembering when I started, and then I have no frame of reference about when to stop. Y'all helped me realize it's 10:15, and I, at an absolute max, I'm gonna walk out of here at 11:30. I'm gonna get down from here at 11:30, and if you got to go somewhere before 11:30, go on. Now it ain't gonna hurt my feelings a bit. I understand deadlines and all that, and I got one too. I don't know if it takes as long to get a suitcase in that airport as it does. But I got to go. So that's the promise. And y'all keep me honest. If anybody sees it get 11:30 and I look like I'm just getting my second wind, ring the bell and we'll quit mid-stroke, I promise you. I've sort of got a direction in mind I'd like to go. Yeah, we say we've only got one story, and that's certainly true in the sense that history doesn't change. Amazingly, though, the story does change enormously, doesn't it? It's a dynamic thing. It isn't a finished product. It's a dynamic thing. It just keeps on happening. Now, I'm always kind of amused when folks say, oh, yeah, I've heard you before. I've heard your story. And I was going, which one? Yeah, because it never does seem to be quite the same. And I like to hit it different ways sometimes. And you know, here we are this morning. We're a group of folks, not only who normally wouldn't mix, but we're a group of folks who, by any standard, really ought not to be here. And here we sit in Marietta, Georgia, on a magnificently beautiful spring morning. Azaleas blooming. Life coming into clear focus as those things emerge just like us. And here we are, just a group of folks that are gathered together. And what we've done is spent a weekend sharing very intimately with each other and just kind of loving one another. It's really what it's about. And I think a lot about who we are and how this thing comes about. And when I listen to us share one with another, I'm always struck with the amazing similarity of us. It looks like our illnesses happen. Certainly they look different and circumstances are different, but it really looks like it happens with a remarkable sameness in terms of what happened. By the way, that old-timers panel could use a lawyer too, couldn't they? Particularly Eileen. She needed one in perpetuity just to handle marriage settlements. And I thought, I married a lot. I'm a rookie. Let me ask you to keep two things in mind here this morning. Just stick it in the back of your mind. Because it's what came to mind when I was thinking about what I wanted to share this morning. And it's a thing that really has a lot of meaning to me. I won't explain, just maybe it'll emerge as we go. One is, what makes you sick makes you well. And we usually think of that in terms of the hair of the dog, the first drink, the morning drink. But what makes you sick makes you well. And the other is, what God would use, he first reduces to nothing. If there's anybody in the world knows that, it's us. We know what being reduced to nothing is all about. And when I think about my illness and where it came from, it seems to me that it did happen in a rather calamitous kind of way, but in a way that was fairly well defined in terms of how it shaped in my life. And when I listen to other alcoholics tell a story, I hear similar kinds of things. And when I think about where my illness started, when I think about what actually caused this guy, a guy who loved booze as much as me, to wind up one who couldn't handle it. Where did it come from? What was it that shaped me in such a way that when booze came into my life, it absolutely lit a Roman candle, and I never looked back from the time I got introduced to booze. And when I think about that, what I think about is it the very seedbed of my alcoholism. I think the beginning had to do with my spiritual life. I was my father was originally from Georgia. He was part of that bunch that came over on the debtors' prison boats or something, settled up in Toccoa. Got more Ivesters up there than Smiths, and it's the only place in the world we exist. They've kept them fairly well corralled in Toccoa. And a few like me ran away. And I was introduced to Bible Belt religion very early on, and with me it didn't take. And I went through, as a child, a rather confused and uncertain and awkward and painful experience with matters religious and with any spiritual life. And what I wound up experiencing was an extreme level of confusion and aggravation and frustration and a continuing war with anything to do with the Spirit. And it went from confusion and aggravation to anger and resentment, and then finally, in the end, cold indifference. You know, there's a saying that or an observation, that the opposite of love is not hate, it's indifference. And when I walked into the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't know the Lord's Prayer nor have any concern about it. And what set up in me was a deeply guarded secret. As a small child, I realized that there was a great deal of that religious experience that I was being taught that I simply didn't believe. And I never shared that with a single human until I got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. Rather, what set up was that guarded secret and a tension-ridden fellow who felt one way on the inside, acted another way on the outside. And I think it was the foundation of what was to be the sitting duck for alcoholism when booze came along. The second thing that really went awry in my life had to do with the emotional thing. I was a guy who was perhaps formed with, or certainly early developed, gaps in the personality that I hear described by every speaker I ever hear. Gaps in the personality in the sense that I was somebody who didn't fit comfortably into life. I was somebody who always felt separate, who always felt isolated, who always felt different, who always felt a certain reluctance to engage in life and to share openly with other people. I think there were lots of reasons for it. It really had to do with the relationship in my primary family. I won't go into this now either, and maybe not even later, but it essentially had to do with me, with my relationship with males. You know, my father deserted our family when I was a small child, 4 years old, and my mother married a series of relatively interesting people. Not as many as Eileen, but she had a fairly good track record. None of them ever clicked with me as a man who could demonstrate to me what a man was about. And so what I grew up with, where there should have been a bonded relationship with males that I could feel closeness with simply didn't happen. And I wound up as somebody who was extremely guarded with other people and never really opened up and felt free with people. Never learned how to solve problems or have intimacy and closeness with guys. Yeah, I made a lot of noise and ran around with gangs of people. But inside, where it really counted, there was never a single person on this earth that knew me or that I really let know me. And so emotionally, where I grew up with that kind of gap in my ability to relate and went through the social misery that so many of us seem to talk about, and that self-centered, fearful isolation that is so characteristic of alcoholism. In fact, our book is riddled with it. Self-centered isolation, the heart of the problem, set in. And so emotionally, and when I got into my formative years, into my teenage years, and discovered booze, my God, it was no mystery why I drank, because what it did was fill the gaps. What it did was give me a sense of adequacy and confidence and comfort and well-being and poise. I would have been stupid not to drink. And what happened was that I took an emotional detour in the process of growing up in the ways that really mattered. When I was about 16, started sucking on that jug to get me through the problems of life, I never grew another inch in the maturing process. I never grew another inch in emotional wellness and in growing. So the seedbed was there very definitely, and I think that was the formation. And then once I started drinking, man, it was Katie bar the door. I just loved that stuff, loved everything about it, loved people who drank, loved how they drank. I loved the excitement and that old razzmatazz and duke them out on Saturday night. Loved every bit of that grinding and carrying on. Almost all of it. Not all, most of it. Because what I found in the third area of my life that I got in serious trouble with was in the social thing. Now, at first, booze for me was a marvelous solution, because what it did, as a 16-year-old kind of tortured adolescent, I guess, or youngster, what it did was made me free as a bird. And when I found booze, man, I found, they call it the social lubricant. They call alcohol the social lubricant. And man, I got a big time grease job when I discovered booze. Because it gave me exactly what I needed to fit in, and for a period. It was the key to a prison. The prison of my life. I'd been in prison my entire life, the prison of my own skin. And so what booze did was open that, and it freed me to be everything I could even imagine wanting to be. And I loved that stuff, man. I was loose as a goose and absolutely having a ball in this thing called life. Drank like an alcoholic right from the very beginning. Don't think I was. I think I might have been in the oven and on the way to becoming, but it wasn't really a fully developed alcoholic. I had some of the characteristics, some of the traits. Don't really believe I was an alcoholic. On the way. And interestingly enough, what at one time freed me, what at one time was the solution to my life, became the problem. Now, I don't know when it happened, but it was characterized by things that I'm sure everybody in this room who's alcoholic has experienced, where at one time I had a sort of strange macho pride in how much I drank. I took pride in the fact that I was always the last guy on his feet. I was always the last guy to want to quit a party. I was always the guy who wanted to drive everybody else home. Took pride in that. And it was almost as if overnight that completely reversed. And rather than exaggerating how much I drank, I started to minimize. Rather than taking pride in how much I drank, I started to feel a private kind of embarrassment about how much I drank. Started to lie the other way and cut it down. Almost as if overnight, what had become the keys to my jail became the keys to put me into jail. And what happened when this thing became a problem for me, I basically built a new prison. I built a new prison. One glass brick after another. Every drink that I took was another brick in that prison that was so powerful I couldn't get out. And nobody else could get in. And what set in was a kind of exquisite loneliness that I think is known only to alcoholics. Now, there are certainly people who know loneliness greater than ours. If you don't believe that, suck up your gut one day and walk into a nursing home. And you'll understand loneliness like few people ever know. But loneliness of alcoholism is different because it has little to do with other people. the presence or absence of other people. It has to do with an inability to be free and to be part of what's going on, to engage in life and to feel a part of what's going on. Most people who experience loneliness, senior citizens who live by themselves, or people who've been recently widowed, or people who are recently divorced, or people in a nursing home, most of their loneliness can be cured by the presence of a caring human. Not so with us, is it? Now, I think the real hell of alcoholism is sitting in a circle of friends or even family and feeling like a total stranger. Feeling like a total stranger. I've known that loneliness in the circle of my family. I've known it sharing Christmas gifts. I've known it in the arms of a loving woman. And felt keen, total isolation. An inability to open up and be a part of somebody else. As a guy that I sponsor in North Carolina, I love to hear him describe this because I think it gets to what the real agony of alcoholism is. When he describes coming home and lying in bed with a wife that he can no longer communicate with, and they both lie there rigid as boards pretending to be asleep because they simply don't know what to say to each other. That's the hell of alcoholism. It's that inability to function as a human and to join in this thing called life, no matter how close the relationship. So that social kind of a prison of alcoholism is what happened. And somewhere in that process, I became alcoholic. I don't know when, doesn't really matter when. Roughly in my 18th year is where that kind of change occurred, and I was to never be the same. I lost control. Although it would have been hard to imagine any control the way I drank, I think there probably was some in those early years, but just as surely that changed. And I became characterized as a guy who simply could not predict what he would do if he took a drink. Now, it was predictable, but I couldn't predict it. And Katie barred the door from there on. Yeah, I'm really not going to tell a whole lot of and I really mean it. I'm not going to, and I love drunkologues. I have enormous respect for drunkologues, especially mine. I mean, I really like drunkologues. I like to wallow around in that stuff, and I think it's healthy to wallow around in that stuff. I don't want to ever get immune to drunkologues. That's for doggone sure. But let me just sum it up this way. If I had to take a look at what my alcoholism looked like, all I would have to do would look at the two extremes of it. You know, if I look at that 16-year-old fellow bounced out of high school up in Belmont, North Carolina, that would be the beginning, particularly when he got flamed on with that rocket juice. Man, I can see him there. But I remember that young fellow bounced out of high school, bright-eyed, bushy-tailed, set out to do his great thing in the world, confident I was going to do wonderful stuff. And then comparing to the fella eight short years later, was living on the streets in the city of Flint, Michigan. My good friend Saginaw knows about. She gave me testimony this weekend that the place I used to live most in Flint, Michigan still stands. I can't believe it. I thought the alcohol would have eaten the cement out of the brick by now with all the guys that stayed in there. It was a Rialto Theater. And 8 short years later, that's where I was, in grungy Flint, Michigan, living on the streets. Now, I didn't fall out of high school into that. That's obvious. And if I had to characterize what happened, you know, how does a guy get from a bright-eyed, bushy-tailed world beater to a trembling denizen of that realm? How does it happen? Yeah, it's if you looked at it, it would look like a runaway train. But that doesn't happen like that. And if I had to describe it, what it looked like was that my life seemed to be an endless series of failures and new starts. And every time I failed and started over, settled for a little less, and a little less, and a little less. So that what at one time would have been totally unthinkable for me, unimaginable, totally unacceptable, became remarkably normal. The only place that I felt comfortable was with people like me. It's kind of like I heard a tape, it was not an AA talk, but a guy was telling how you cook a bullfrog. Never wanted to, but it caught my eye. And he said, how you cook a bullfrog is that you don't put him in hot water, the sucker will jump out. He said, what you do is take a pan of cool water, and you put him in there. And being an aquatic creature, he'll start just sort of swimming around. And then you turn the heat on, and it starts getting warm. And the sap thinks he's in a jacuzzi or something. You know, he'll start just doing black strokes and all that kind of stuff and loving every minute of it. And the heat comes up. And before he realized what's going on, he becomes a frog leg. And when I saw that, I thought, God, that's what happened to me. Yeah, I took off like a runaway train, but somewhere in the process, I got cooked. Yeah, I became an alcoholic. I don't really know when, but that's what happened. But it looked like, if I look at it, just an endless series of failures and new starts and working my way down. Yeah, I have absolutely no illusions about what alcoholism represents in my life, none whatsoever, because I remember in vivid detail exactly what that existence was like. The next thing that got in trouble with me, and I think alcoholism was fairly well taken shape by now, but the thing, next thing that took shape with me was in the mental area. Now, we all know, we learned in fifth grade health that alcohol destroys cells. We know that. We know that it destroys brain cells. Every drink we take has a certain price tag to it. The good news is that we've got more than we need anyway. I mean, no, we don't use even a small fraction of what we have. And most of us really don't last long enough to even see noticeable effects of that. Very amazing that you look in this room full of people, few of us went far enough to really see evidence of the damage. Very few of us. Ray said it last night, I think, very well, that there is a line beyond which we do not go. There's a level of pain beyond which we do not go. And those of us who go beyond that line, nobody needs to introduce them. I guarantee you, if one of us in this room crossed that line, every other one of us would know it. When I meet somebody who's gone to that dimension, and you see a remarkable few, it's almost like a Bataan death march survivor. And every time I meet one, I get goose pimples. The hair stands up on the back of my neck because I'm looking at somebody who simply can't recover. But miraculously, some do. Most of us don't get there. Most of us lose something, I guess. But that's not really the key thing to me. The key thing to me in terms of what happened mentally is the thing that's probably the most important field of battle where I'll spend the rest of my life. And it has to do with that thing that I described when booze resoundingly presented itself as a solution in my life. And I didn't just form a belief, a knowledge that booze was a solution for me. It's as if it were branded on my brain. Indelibly imprinted, never to go away. I will guarantee you, of the stuff that I've learned in my life, I have never learned anything more profoundly than how marvelous a solution booze is for this guy. Now, that's important to know. It's also the most dangerous thing that I know, because that knowledge will never go away. Silkworth describes it well in the Doc's Opinion, where he talks about that sense of restlessness and irritability and discontent. More importantly, he talks about that absolute knowledge you and I have of the ease and comfort that comes with a few drinks. You see, the truth of what I know about alcoholism and about what alcohol will do for me is a lot more dangerous. Because when I get up against it, I know that relief. Dangerous knowledge. Very important for me to understand that. And that sure knowledge is part of what is mentally important for me to understand about my illness. It's also important for me to understand about the obsessive nature of my alcoholism. Now, I don't need to understand all of what that means. I simply know that there is something about my mind that causes it at times to turn irresistibly to the thought of a dream. I don't understand that. I just know that it happens. Now, it hasn't happened to me for a number of years, but I'm not one of the old-timey religion types who says, well, it's been plucked out and it's gone. If you read that in the book, read just a little bit more closely. Read just a little bit more closely. Because it sounds like that, but if you read just a couple of lines later, what it says is that what we have in reality is what? A daily reprieve. Contingent on our spiritual condition. Let me tell you just one quick example of what, because I think it's critical. I think it's awfully critical to understand the nature of that obsession, and when it hits, it doesn't mean you're a bad person. It doesn't mean you're phony. It doesn't mean you're insincere. It means that you're alcoholic. And all I have to do to revisit is turn loose a bit on the spiritual program. I'm one who believes this program works as long as I use it and not one more second. There is no staying power. There is no coasting power. I'm either current or I'm going backward. Let me tell you, the first time I ever encountered it, to my knowledge, I'd been sober 3.5 years, very active then as now. No real difficulties that I was aware of. I had a life coming together, but I was a euphoric member of Alcoholics Anonymous, a very active member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Had to make a plane trip. No big deal. The only thing different about it was that it was a jet and I'd never been on one. And I was probably a little excited about that, but there was no problem. There was nothing driving. I was just innocent as a young goat. Yeah, I got on that plane, took off. And you know how to do, man. They don't even settle down. They just still climb and they start selling that hooch. And so here these ladies start pulling that buggy up there. I was at the front of the plane, thank God. And they started at the back, and I heard them hit the aisle with that, heard it 100 times. But then I heard it. You know what I mean? I heard it. All at once, it got through to me, and with absolutely no provocation beyond that, I was overwhelmed with a gut-wrenching obsession to drink. Now, I'm not talking about silly thinking like, wouldn't a drink be nice? That's not the issue. I was not even thinking that stuff of, well, I'm 30,000 feet in the air, who would know? I'm not even thinking, well, maybe I'm not really an alcoholic. From the time I fully admitted that, I have never questioned it to this day. I knew I was an alcoholic. I also knew I didn't want to drink. Fellow alcoholics, I did not want to drink. But I knew I was going to drink. I knew that. Took a dollar bill out of my pocket, stuck it in my shirt pocket, and sat there sweating bullets. That's an obsession. It's an absolutely irresistible force. I knew I was going to drink. I didn't want to drink. What do? Call your sponsor? Good luck. Catch a meeting? Forget it. I tell you what you do. Based on my experience, you are either well prepared to deal with that or, honey, you are dead meat. As simple as that. I think we lose many alcoholics who are ill prepared to deal with that. Now, I get real uncomfortable. I'm comfortable in most meetings and most settings, but I get real uncomfortable when I'm around somebody who's new in the program and has gotten caught up in this notion that, well, not a notion, but whose experience has been that they've been here 6 months or a year and a half, and I haven't had a desire to drink since I've been here. And the next line, though unspoken, says, and I ain't going to. Maybe, maybe. And I hope that's the case. But I also hope that you operate with that grim reality that what we're talking about is a killer illness and not just some sort of social nuisance. We're talking about a lifelong condition. It is not going to get better. It is not going to change. That reality is going to change. That it stay there. And so that's what that obsession is about, that it happens. Well, anyway, enough about that. Mentally, it's a mental obsession, and I need to understand that's the most prominent problem that I have to deal with. The physical will never bother me. And the physical is the last place that the illness sets its hook, I think. Surely did with me. And physical to me, it's not just a matter of deterioration or what happened to me when I get my nose broke or that kind of stuff. The physical has to do with something I don't understand. I don't need to understand. It has to do with something that happened to me that doesn't happen to other people. I don't know what happened, but something happened to me physically so that my drinking would never be the same. And it would never be like any other drinker in the world except other alcoholics. In the sense that if I took one drink, I could not predict my behavior. Could not predict it. I never understood that for a long time. When I first came to AA and heard people talking about the first drink, I swear to God, it made no sense to me. Because what it sounded like they were saying was that they took a drink and had a running fit or something, you know, and just went crazy. Well, I never did that. Yeah, when I took a drink, all I did was take another drink. And then wake up in the wrong state, you know, or in jail, or in a burning car, mine. I never understood that. What I need to understand at a cellular level is that I am not like other drinkers, nor will I ever be. I have a permanent, hopeless condition called alcoholism, and the physical is what made that hit home. I won't be the same. And I need to understand that. I need to understand that it's not just a matter of acknowledging that I'm in trouble. It's admitting at the core of my being that I'm powerless over alcohol. It's not that I elect not to drink, it's that I recognize that I cannot drink. So there's no fight. And so that's what happened. The course of events just went wild. Many of you know that you know, when I hit the street up there and I wish I could tell you that one day I just saw a bright light and came out and sought help, found it, and everything been okay since, but that's just not the way it happened. Rather, I was one who wound up doing, before I got here, the kind of thing that I know every alcoholic in this room, in this world, is fear of doing. Never met an alcoholic who hadn't had panicky kinds of fears and experience of waking up in the morning with that frantic feeling of what did I do? What did I do? Where was I? What happened? Heard thousands and thousands of alcoholics, and I've been one of them, describe going out to look at the car to see if it's there, to see if it's in one piece, to see if there's blood on it, breathe a sigh of relief, and go out and do it again. Woke up one morning in jail in Flint, no novelty. I'd been there more times than I could count. Knew everybody that worked at that place. Took it for granted that I was in there for the same as always, drunk, hustling, fighting, whatever. And a guy came by after I was awake for a while. A guy came by, a jailer. I knew him well. Asked him when I could get out, and he said, "I hope never." And walked off, and I didn't know what he was talking about. Had no earthly idea. And then some of the other guys in there told me that the night before, driving somebody's car down Main Street of the city, I'd run over and killed two people. You know, the mind is a peculiar thing. I don't understand much about it, but I understand this. It won't accept what it can't handle. That explains a lot of behavior to me. It won't accept what it can't handle. And I just simply couldn't deal with that, and then gradually accepted the truth. You know, some folks say that if it gets serious enough, that you'll quit. And I would have believed that at that point. Stayed in jail 76 days, knew that I would never take another drink. I knew that. The guilt was too great. I just simply could not fathom taking a drink. Got out, released on bond. My folks found me and got me released on bond. I stayed sober a day and a half. And then, of course, I drank. From July to November of 56, like nobody I've ever seen. I have never seen an alcoholic like me. And I've worked with literally thousands of alcoholics. I don't mean I was the world's worst. I was the world's most pathetic. I was a guy obviously trying to drink himself to death. The fight was gone. And I peeked over that line that Ray was talking about, the land of no return. Well,
obviously that didn't happen, and in November the 19th, the 56th, was actually the date of my last drink. I finished a bottle of gin, went to court, not a trial in the sense of the kind we see today, but it certainly, it was no trial. I had no defense. You know, the law allows a plea called stand mute. And that was an eloquent way to say what I had to say, but what do you say? I have no recollection of what happened then or now. I just know that it happened. And I thought I said it all when my attorney said, stand mute. And I was, they had to tell me what I'd done. And I was found guilty and sentenced to max of 15 years in the Michigan State Penitentiary. I knew I was going away. That was no surprise, and yet it was a shock. I mean, you know, I don't think there's any human that can face going to a penitentiary that's not going to have an instinctive reaction of fear. And certainly, you know, I'd been in jails and pea farms and stockades and lockups all of my drinking career, but I knew that a penitentiary was a different ball of wax. And the next day I walked into that place absolutely resigned to my fate, never believed I would ever come out of there alive. Truly did not believe I'd come out of there alive. Little did I know that, you know, there used to be a thing that you heard associated with AA you don't hear too much. We call this the Fellowship of the Last Resort. That's a good name for it for us, because where do we go if we don't make it here? Fellowship of the Last Resort. And that certainly was true for me. I was introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous there, didn't seek it out. Even though I had been the kind of cut up that I described, I didn't really believe I was an alcoholic. I never had really thought about it that much. Yeah, I'd had it mentioned to me. I'd been diagnosed a number of times, but I never really had any belief that I was an alcoholic. So when it hit that institution, a staff member there interviewed me, had referred me to AA, and I walked into my first meeting, probably much like you walked into yours. Mine was Groundhog Day, 1957. That's the date of my sobriety, and I've never looked back. I've never had another drink from that day to this. And it's an amazing thing to me that that's the case, because I'm probably as unlikely a candidate as ever darkened the door. I didn't believe I had the condition. I knew without any question that I had absolutely no quality that said I deserved anything. I mean, nothing. I felt so enormously guilty to even be breathing, much less walking into a place of hope and help. There was just no way you could reconcile that. But I walked into that first meeting. No earthly idea of what to expect, and I listened to a guy tell his story. Now, I'd heard alcoholics tell stories before, but not their own. And it was obvious that was his own. Nobody gonna make up a lie like that. And I never heard anything like that. I'd never heard an alcoholic talk like that. And he told that story. Now, he was as unlike me as anybody I've ever seen in my life. But I'll always be grateful to him. He became my first sponsor. Loved him better than Peter loved the Lord. His name was Chai Walker. He was a magnificent guy. He was area delegate in 1957 for the state of Michigan. Great guy. Had about a third grade education. He was a little short, plug-ugly fella. He was an ex-everything. That guy had done everything known to man. He'd been a professional boxer at one time, and apparently a very bad one. Because he was a beat-up little old guy. But I'll always be grateful, because even though I didn't identify with his experience, I know that guy made a tremendous impression in my life. Because what he had was that magnificent gift of enthusiasm. Magnificent gift. What brought me back to Alcoholics Anonymous was not the example, not the experience. He was not like me. I was a different kind of man. But it was the spirit of that man, because I think I knew that maybe, just maybe, there was something here. It was like a moth to a flame. Apparently, I must have had a wisp of hope or something and kept going back. I stayed in that place 3.5 years and never missed a single meeting, whether it was once a week or once a day or whatever. And the miracle happened. And celebrate the miracle is a good thing, because I really do believe that the fact that I walked in here and have never had a drink since and have found a brand new way to live, new and different than anything I ever imagined in my wildest dreams, is just absolute nothing short of a miracle. Now, a miracle to me is not an accident. I think miracles are very logical kinds of things as well as deeply spiritual things. They have a lot to do with preparation and opportunity. And when I'm well prepared and I'm in the place for things to happen and the door opens, the miracle is that I see it and I do it. You know, it's not laying on hands and whoopee stuff. I think miracles are very real, explainable things, not just mysterious things that we sometimes can't explain. So anyway, that's what happened with me. And, you know, when I look at that, there were a lot of things that were significant in that turnaround for this young guy. I sat in those meetings for a long time feeling totally different than anybody else in there, and I know that most of us go through that. I felt that keen sense of isolation and fearful separation that I'd known probably more than at any time in my drinking. There's no place more miserable than a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous when you ain't with it. You know, most of us here this morning find this a warm and loving environment. I'll guarantee you there's at least one somebody sitting here who feels like they just fell out of a spaceship. There's at least one somebody here who feels none of this, who says, what is this mumbo jumbo? I guarantee you that's the case. And I was that person for a long time. First 8 months in AA, I truly believe was as miserable as any period I ever endured in my life. But there were things going on. I was extremely fortunate in that the group I went into, the recovery group of Jackson, was a fine group of Alcoholics Anonymous, a fine group. It was in a maximum custody joint, and it's still my home group. I mean, I don't go to meetings. I don't want to go to meetings there. About every couple of years, I go to make sure that my chair is still there and I ain't in it. And that maybe I can say a little something to the guy who is. I go every couple of years. They don't even know me now, but I know who I am, and I know why I'm there. But that was an excellent group. And what I mean by that, it was a well-ordered, structured group that did run about the business of carrying out the fifth tradition. That was a group that had a purpose, and the purpose was to carry its message to the alcoholic still suffering. A well-ordered group, a group that did a fine job of introducing people to this process. And I'll always be grateful for that, a good, fundamental, no-nonsense grounding in the fact that what we had in Alcoholics Anonymous was not some mystical tent show, that what we had here is a program characterized by a design for living second to none. And I was introduced to that basic information when I went in. I'll always be grateful for that. The other thing that I was introduced to here for the first time in my life was the language of the heart that we hear described in sort of mystical terms sometimes. But that language of the heart, that absolute value of one alcoholic relating to another. And those people who walked into that institution every week of that 3.5 years, somebody came in from every other week. Somebody came in from the outside and stuck out the hand of fellowship. No, not one single time did anybody ever walk in, stick out a hand with any expectation of me putting anything in it, because I had nothing to put in it but a broken and wasted life. Didn't know that's what they were looking for. That was a lifeline for me, a real lifeline to me. So anyway, when I look at what happened in terms of that experience, you know, I described in a way how alcoholism came about. And I guess it's no real surprise that recovery occurs essentially the same way, you know, that the process of healing just actually reverses the process of the illness. At least in my case, you know, that first place that I got well was in the physical area. It's no big deal getting well physically. The only thing I have to do to get well physically is not drink. That's the only thing. I don't have to eat health food, take exercise, jog, thank God. Don't have to do any of that. All I have to do is not drink, and I'll get as well as I'm going to get.
And fairly quickly. Most of us don't even need hospitalization. My God, I did that hundreds of times. But it isn't enough, is it? Because getting well physically has to do with really understanding at depth what the issue is for me physically. And it's the sure recognition that there is no battle. It's a surrender process to the fact that I can't drink. And I need to know that at a cellular level, the issue is that I can't drink. I'm an alcoholic. I hear folks sometimes talk about, and I understand it, I talked about it myself for a number of years, about the miraculous restoration of choice. Really not an operative term with me in terms of the physical reality of who I am and what I'm about. A choice is a weighing of things. A choice is considering options. And what I have to understand is that for me, I don't care what the situation is, alcohol is not an option. Bottom line. Very important for me to understand that. It's important for me, like when I'm talking with somebody that's had trouble, when they've been in the program and gone back out, I never get caught up in causation. I don't want to talk about conditions. I don't care whether it was getting fired or divorced or having lung cancer. I don't care what it is in terms of what needs to be dealt with. The one non-negotiable issue in my life is that I don't drink. It is simply not an option. And when I know that fundamentally and soundly, it helps me to get prepared to learn how to hang on. I hear folks say that if I can't be happy, I might as well be drunk. Well, my dear, if you feel that way, you'll get a chance to find out if you mean it. This ain't Disneyland. This is not La La Land. This is the land of the world. And sometimes it is magnificent. And sometimes it pure sucks. It sucks. You got mountains, you got valleys, and you got a whole bunch of just flat living. Interesting that in the vision it doesn't say that we galloped along the road of happy destiny. It said we trudge that sucker. And sometimes we do. So I like to be very, very realistic and very, very hard-nosed about this issue of what physical healing's about. It's more than just clearing up. It's more than just getting the alcohol out of my system. It's about understanding the physical reality of what I'm about and therefore being girded for the fight. Basically, same thing mental. If I don't drink, the best I can understand from observation and from listening to people describe it and know what they're talking about, the mental recovery, so to speak, takes about a year. Maybe why they tell us not to do anything drastic in that first year, that the noodle ain't wrung out yet, it just ain't ready. About a year. And then that residual stuff is gone and it gets as good as it's going to get. It doesn't come back. So I might as well be happy with what I got. That's all it is. There ain't no more. Won't be anymore. The only thing that I have to understand is about how to deal with that obsession. The primary problem of the alcoholic is in his mind, not in his body. And so what I have to learn is powerfully how to deal with what happens when it rains on the parade. What happens when the monkey gets on my back? Because I want to stay sober then too. And what I have to understand is the power of what this program's about. Of learning to take the long view, of learning to hang on, of learning to be tough-minded. I guarantee you, I've never seen a single alcoholic with any long-term recovery who hasn't gone through some dark valleys and fought some major league fights. That's just the way it is. That's life. That's what we get restored to is life. And understanding the enemy that they call my mind is a critically important thing. And then I moved into the real difference. You know, what I've described so far, in a sense, except for the reality of it, I went through hundreds of times. What is it that made the difference the last time I got sober? And it's what happened beyond that, because it's more than just steely resolve. It's more than just white knuckle. It's more than just just Green Beret holding the beach. It's more than that. Because what we have to have is relief. What we have to have is some help. Just getting by that way would be a tough way to do it, even if it worked. And so the next thing that happened to me was the social thing. I described that period in those early months in Alcoholics Anonymous when this was a miserable place. Think about the powerful value of the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. Never mind the program. Think about the power of the fellowship. Here we sit in Marietta, Georgia. A group of people who would normally not mix. We speak different languages. It seems like some are from Massachusetts. I met Betsy this morning. Been here 24 years. Sound like she just fell off the truck today. But we're people who normally wouldn't mix, and yet we're a group of people who love each other in a very special way. You walk into this place this weekend or any meeting in this world, and you can walk in unannounced and unexplained. You never have to explain yourself to a single person. And you're at home. And instant acceptance and support, second to none, the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. Just simply being a part and feeling what recovery is about as embodied here. I'm a member of the Big Book group in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm a great believer in the value of home groups, because I think home groups is where that really gets solidified and it really gets legitimized and it becomes a real part of recovery. You see, I'm a member of that group. It's as much a part of my identity as my family. It's as much a part of my identity as my fingerprints. I'm part of that group. I'm a member of that group this morning. I interact with that group. There's a thing called group karma, I guess you would call it. It's sort of a spirit, that an enveloping spirit that takes in its members. And I feel that. That's a part of this sense of the fellowship and the belonging that's so critically important. You know, those aren't hard things to get. You know, when you don't have it, it seems like it's eons away when you don't have it. But it's the easiest thing in the world to get. All it takes is simply getting involved in the action of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm not even talking about steps yet. I'm talking about the action. I watched a group last night getting ready for that dance. And there were people rushing about and putting the chairs. Didn't a single person picked up a chair, didn't feel better. Not a single one. Who didn't feel more close kinship to what this is about. You know, you hear us encouraging newer members to get involved. It's not because we need help with chairs. It's because we recognize the tremendous importance of the therapy of involvement. And when I get into the action of Alcoholics Anonymous, I experience that priceless thing called a sense of belonging. I no longer wander alone over the face of this earth. I'm at home at last. I'm at peace. I'm with my fellows. Tremendously important thing. Easy to get. It simply involves getting physically involved with the action that makes you part. Meetings are wonderful things. I'm a great believer in meetings. I'm a great believer in open meetings. I think they're awfully important. I know that there are families here this morning, and I think it's awfully important to have open meetings so that our family and friends can be part of what we're about, because they truly are part of what we're about. And good things can happen when a couple sits and listens to somebody other than themselves describe alcoholism. Great place for healing and getting those relationships going again. Tremendously important. I'm an even stronger believer in closed meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm somebody who believes that it's not just nice to have, but it is vital to have for recovery to happen. The first time I ever sat in a meeting and honestly said, not just words, but honestly said, I'm an alcoholic, I about halfway expected somebody to protest and say, oh, no, no, not a nice fellow like you. Yeah, you're a lot too smart for that. What a relief when nobody said a word. Remember the first time that you sat in a meeting and you shared something that you promised God you'd never tell anybody? See, a thing happens in closed meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous called trust. Called trust. When we learn that we can actually be ourselves with somebody and let them know us. God, what an freeing thing from the bondage of self and isolation. I believe very much in the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, just being a part of this thing. And then the real work starts. Yeah, that goes on forever. The real work starts. Because the emotional thing, it's interesting that, you know, it's really not enough just to get steely resolved that I can't drink, an awareness that my mind's the enemy and I got to be on guard about that sucker. It's not enough to have fellowship because we have to go home sometime. So what do we do when the fellowship ain't there? What do you do when you're on the airplane and the monkey bites you? What do you do? Now, this is not just about not drinking. It's about being free. I participate in a conference we call our conference Freedom from Bondage. What a tremendous message. To be free. You know, the key is, how can I live in such a way that I don't need to drink? And no mystery about where that comes from. It's wrapped up in our program of recovery called the 12 Steps. The hardest work I've ever done in my life. Why not? All I wanted to do is completely reorder my entire life. The hardest thing I've ever done. When I look at that, you know, I just mention this and pass on. But yeah, I'm always amazed at the logic of our program, the design of it. Now, I'm a manager. I've been a manager for 30 years. And my life is eaten up with plan making and objective setting and goal design and all that kind of stuff. Management plans, that's what I do. And I've seen some good ones. I've seen some zoos too. But the most logical plan, organizational plan that I've ever seen in my life is a program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I've never seen a management plan that more clearly delineated the actions to take, that more clearly established exactly what would happen. Incremental reports on whether you're making it or not. I've never seen a more logical design. Didn't look that way when I first looked at it. It tells us in no uncertain terms what happens if we don't do it. Oh, yeah. And when I look at it, it just basically breaks down to three things with me. The first three steps have to do with my relationship with God. That's the foundation of my recovery. That war that started in me as a child has to be righted. And what it gives me is the tool to fight the devils that come. That basic relationship with a power that I believe in. That's current and active and real in my life. And not just some mythical kind of thing that I wished I believed, but a real functional relationship with a power. First three. And the next four, the way I see them in my life has to do with my relationship with me, where I inventory and share for the first time in my life intimately with another human. And then I make the critical decisions that I truly want to change. I want to be different. I want to take on a new boss and a new set of principles, a new way to live. Powerful thing, learning to get in tune with me for the first time in my entire life. And then the next five basically have to do with my relationship with the rest of the world, with the rest of the people around me. That's easy and trite to say. I mean, yeah, I really believe that, you know, when we talk about bondage and we talk about needing to be free and all of that, it's kind of easy to stop short on what we're talking about. It sounds like if we get free and we don't want to drink that we're free. But it's amazing how deep-seated this thing, isn't it? Let me just give you one example. I mentioned about the musical fathers in my house and none click. When I was sober, well, if you had asked me, during my drinking years or in my early years of recovery, probably the first 10 years, about that area of my life, I'd have said nothing to it. If you'd asked me about my father, I'd say I never had one, really, and it never did matter to me. Not that simple, is it? You don't really understand how valuable something is that you never had. And I never understood the enormous impact of the lack of a real male guy that could show me what a man was like till I had a son of my own and I watched him interacting with me. And then the light started to come. And I'd probably been sober, I don't even know how long it was, several years, a number of years. And I started to be troubled with the fact that I needed to make amends to my dad. And I didn't know the guy. I wouldn't have known him if I'd have met him in the mall. I mean, and you talk about a schizoid conversation. I'm saying you got to make amends. I said, you nuts, I ain't making amends. That turkey, all he ever did is abandon the family. Yeah, I'm injured. Why would I make amends? And then I understood that the process is about my freedom, not his. It's about cleaning my side of the street, not his. It's about my sonhood, not his fatherhood. Finally got it through my head, went to find him. He lived down in South Carolina, served him right. Where he ought to be. And I found him and went to see him. He was standing out in his backyard. I walked up to him. He's talking to a neighbor. He didn't know me from a tomcat. I told him who it was, and it embarrassed him a little bit, and this other fellow left, and I finally got around to tell him what I was there for. Now, it made no sense to him. I have never tried to make intimate personal amends to anybody that didn't want to pat me on the head and say, no, don't do it. They're always embarrassed by it. They don't know how to deal with it. And so I finally got across to him what I've had to get across to everybody, that it really isn't about them, that it's about me, and I proceeded to make amends. And see, what I didn't know is that where that experience should have been in my life, there'd been this constant ball of just anger. So deeply buried, I didn't even know it was there, but it came when the time was right. And I walked away from there a free man. Now, there was no restoration in that relationship. There was nothing to restore. It was not there. But I walked away a free man. Because, see, when you look at freedom from bondage, it's the bondage of self, not the bondage of booze. And every time I owed amends, it's because there was a warped and damaged relationship that owned a piece of me. Every time I misused and abused somebody, it cost me in my soul. And that's what it's about. It's about being free of that so that I can function and look my fellow man in the eye. That's about freedom. And so that group of steps to me has to do with... Of course, it's tough work. But God, what a relief. God, what a release. God, what a new way to live. And so it has to do with that nitty-gritty freedom. And then, 10 just says it's not to get in that mess anymore. And then 11 and 12, the last two, really are powerful things to me because they tell me what to do with my recovery. 11 basically tells me how to get that power that was lacking in my life. Lack of power was our dilemma. And 11 says, here's how you do it. You seek through prayer and meditation to improve the contact. And then something that I like very much. What do you do with your recovery? What's mine about? I really like the way that 11 is dealt with in our book because it has a line or two in there that really says what gets the message to me. Of what is our purpose? What are we about? What are you and I about as members of this movement? And what it says in so many words is that our real purpose here is not to fix ourselves. If you see one of us who spends all of our time checking our emotional pulse, you're looking at one of us in trouble. Hey, what it's about is it's not about fixing yourself. It's a selfish program to be sure, but it's a peculiar kind of selfishness. It's about 10% gimme. And it's about 90% give, because we have to learn that marvelous truth that we don't keep this sucker by keeping it. We keep it by actively being a conduit to this thing called life. And 11 is what opens that up to me. It's what opens up, because when we pray and when we meditate, what we try to do is find God's will.
And that line says our deal is not to fix ourselves, it's to be a maximum service to God and those about us. The most free people I've ever met in my life are those who are tightly married to a commitment to be a vessel in this thing called Alcoholics Anonymous. Well, in 12 just sort of puts it in motion. And what it tells me is that this spiritual rebirth, this spiritual awakening comes from the steps. It's a product of the steps. It's not patched over, repaired stuff that I got sick on as a kid. It's a brand new, viable, spiritual way of life. Yeah, I'm somebody who I'm a pretty practical-minded fellow. I don't get into a lot of lofty stuff. And it's not because I don't know that there's lofty stuff, but it's because I like very much to be in tune. It's okay to have your head in the clouds, but it's awfully important to have your feet solidly on the ground. Now, when I first heard people talking about the spiritual life, I'd hear folk, and it sounded weird to me. I'd hear people, and all I could think about was tents and snakes and stuff like that. And I hear people talk about prayer life and all that and how it worked in their lives. And what it sounded to me like was that folks say they were driving down Atlanta and they needed a parking place and they'd pray and the car would just disappear and they'd have a parking place right there. That's what it sounded like. Well, my life never had worked like that. I guess when people listen to me now, they think I sound the same way because I see it entirely differently. Yeah, I see it as being integral to how I live. You know, my spiritual life really isn't a theory. It's something that permeates everything that I do. You know, it's either everything or it's nothing. And so what I find is just a marvelous kind of thing. It's a real shirt sleeves, blue collar kind of thing that I do because I use it in my life. And I use it in the things that I do. And it's a thing, it's not mystical at all. It's a thing of simply being in tune with what I believe. I read an article in the Grapevine a few years back that some of the lady wrote that I really thought said something important. I heard Keith talking about it yesterday morning. And then she wrote, the name of her article was Moments. And what she was talking about, and I know that everybody here has probably experienced it, that there are times when you're just absolutely overcome with joy. You know, that there are times when everything feels so ridiculously right that you just don't know what to do. And your cup runs over, and you're overjoyed. Now, those are moments. You know, they're not constant, they're moments. I had one of those experiences I was in O'Hare Airport in Chicago. Airports are grim places. Nobody's happy in airports. I mean, nobody. Everybody looks mad. You know, the people that work there, the pilots, the passengers, everybody looks mad. They try to grin, but everybody's mad about something. Bags didn't come in. Everybody just cussing. Pat wanted to smoke. And normally you got a game face for the airport. You know, when you go in an airport, you look next time you go in one and look at the expressions. Everybody looks like they're in pain. They're just stalking. I mean, they got 4 hours for a plane, and they're still just stalking, you know. Well, I was walking down the concourse in O'Hare, and all at once it dawned on me I was grinning. I mean, about nothing. I mean, you look kind of stupid in an airport walking down the concourse grinning. So I was immediately embarrassed and put my game face back on. But I thought about that later. I mean, you know, because why on earth would you have it then? I was on the way to Fargo, North Dakota in February. I mean, man, that's got to be a grim task in February. And I guess what it came down to is just what Keith said. That day, I was exactly who I was supposed to be. And I was exactly where I was supposed to be and doing exactly what I was supposed to be doing. And the result was one of those moments. And to me, that's what the spiritual thing is about. It's about doing the deal. It's about taking the steps. It's about following the process. It's about giving myself to this simple program and getting out of the level of comfort and convenience. I hear folks talk about what they really aspire to is being comfortable in Alcoholics Anonymous. When I get comfortable, I better be a little suspect. Because that isn't what it's about. A friend of mine that's a religious person says that her task is to comfort the afflicted and afflict the comforted. And that's kind of the way I look at it today. When I see folks that are just sort of benignly drifting along, doing nothing, and just kind of going into a brain-dead two-step, I always kind of feel challenged by that. I always think, Jesus, why don't you get in the parade, man? Don't just stand there and watch it go. Get in this sucker. Because that's what it's about. You know, it's the spiritual life, not a theory. You've got to live this thing. You've got to be in the business of trying to find God's will. And that's where the joy is. That's where the joy is. Well, you know, it's interesting. Well, people always chew me out if I don't tell all the wonderful stuff that happened. I'm just not going to do it. Y'all ask somebody else about where this stuff's gone. I've had an unbelievable career. I wound up getting out of prison and eventually went to work in one and was a warden for about 20 years. And there just ain't no way. I'm kind of like Francine was saying, you can't get there from here. I mean, there ain't no way. But I want to talk about something a little bit different. Because that, you know, that sounds kind of theological to talk about being in the Spirit and all that kind of stuff. Yeah, I tell you, when I think about what that means, you know, what is it that produces this feeling of real joy? What is it that it's like in the preface to the 12 by 12, there's a line that I like very much because I think it describes this whole deal. It's describing what the process of recovery is about. And it says that our step, in so many words, says our steps are a group of principles, spiritual in their nature, that if practiced is a way of life, will expel, interesting word, will expel the obsession to drink. Didn't say he's going to cast it away, but he's going to expel that sucker. And render the sufferer usefully whole. What a great promise. In those early days, I used to wonder, what's it all about? What's my life going to be? And so now here I am 38 years later. What does it really mean? What does it really mean? Mike and I were talking about an experience that I had just a while back where I had a near miss on an airplane. I really thought it was over. It's interesting what comes to mind. You know, think about it for a minute. Think about it for a minute. Not the near miss, but think about it for a minute. You think about the last time that you were absolutely overrun with joy. Think about the last time that you were so happy you felt left-handed. Think about the last time that you were so doggone proud to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous that you just wish you could get on top of Peachtree Towers and tell Atlanta. And where'd it come from? I will absolutely guarantee you, whether I know you or not, I will absolutely guarantee you that that had nothing to do with success. It had nothing to do with achievement or attainment, zero. What it had to do with was that time when you had that special experience of knowing that you were involved in somebody else's life and it made a difference. It made a difference. That's the joy. That's the key, the ultimate key to the prison of self. When I can get past that little narrow thing of me, 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 and start to understand that this is a we thing. It's not a me thing. This is a we thing. I'll just wrap up with this one story to illustrate what I'm talking about. I was back in North Carolina. They released me from Michigan. They did it on condition I go to North Carolina, and after much thought, I agreed to go. About three-tenths of a second, maybe. And I was fantastically active in the program, always have been. And I was wailing away and working with everybody that was dumb enough to call me. And working with a whole lot of folks who didn't call me. I just go get them. I got a letter one day from the women's penitentiary in Raleigh, in my state. Yeah, I was the only guy there dumb enough to work with women. I was the only single guy in the group. And I tell you, drunk women are a major challenge. They really are. And my mother used to go on 12-step call with me to take care of her little boy. Yeah, that one taught me, don't go alone, take mama. And she'd been on far more 12-step calls than most members, I guarantee you. But anyway, I was working women. I guess the word got around that there was a nut up there that would do it. So I got this letter from the women's penitentiary that said they had a gal. I was 28 years old, and they had a 26-year-old gal in the women's prison that was getting ready to come back to my town, and they wanted to know if I would work with her. Well, I mean, this doesn't end at the altar, and I'll tell you in front, but she had a kind of a rough deal. She was in for hooking. I mean, she was a prostitute. And I thought, my God, what are they trying to do to me, man? Send me her. And I didn't want her. But I had a moral duty to do it. So I made up my mind that there ain't no way some hooker going to make it out of women's prison. I knew that. So I got me a little stack of pamphlets, and I went down the day she was coming home to see her. What I meant to do is give her the pamphlets and tell her where the meeting was and never see her again is really what I thought. Doesn't pay to ever get too entrenched in what you think. Because I knocked on the door when she came to the door. What I saw was probably the most spiritually hungry person that I've ever seen. The canned talk went right out the window. I mean, it was done. And I went in and shared. And we started what was to be a marvelous experience introduced her to Alcoholics Anonymous in that area. She was not a handsome girl at all. It's a good thing hookers work at night, because she'd have never made it in the daytime. She wasn't all that bad, but she was a disfigured person. She, pardon the phrase, she was what they call cockeyed. You know, one eye went one way, one at the other. And the poor thing was so handicapped with that, she couldn't even look at you. If she talked to you, she'd look at the floor. Well, she really wanted to do something. First time I got her to talk in the A group one time, and the only way she'd do it, I had to go in early and unscrew the light bulbs at the front of the room. Well, it was going, and she told her story that night, by the way, and I mean she told it. A little bunch of blue-haired ladies sitting in that room, she shocked them something fierce. So as I explained to her on the way back what the general nature is about, you know, she didn't tell anybody more except me and her fifth step. But anyway, yeah, we just got off and running. And I learned something about, I never heard of it. I learned something about vocational rehabilitation. Somebody told me they had a lot of money. They worked with folks that had a hard time getting jobs and things. And I said, well, shoot, I checked it out. Sure enough, told me, yeah, man, we got money. We work with folks like that. So I took her down there. Don't you know that they took a look, got her examined, they said, shoot, we can fix that. She'd been crippled for 26 years. Now, I didn't do anything. All I did was find a door and say, go get them, Tiger. That's all I did. And she went in there, told her she could fix it, got her some surgery. Came out of there, eyes straight as mine. Seventeen visits with a shrink to learn how to be a real person. I don't guess I need to tell you she never looked back, do I? Didn't look down anymore. 26 years later, she died with continued sobriety. Well, when you get to thinking about what does it mean? What's my recovery about? What have I done with this thing that God's given me so freely? He obviously didn't give it to me because I deserved it. He didn't give it to me because I was a good guy. He didn't give it to me because I wanted it. I don't know why he gave it to me. I just know that he did. And I don't think he gave it to me just so I could sit back and comfortably reside in it. And when I think about what this recovery's been about, what's this legacy that I'll leave behind? I remember Margaret and hundreds of others You see, that's the joy of this thing. It's about opening up, turning in. If you're not loving every minute of this sucker, if you're not just as happy as you can possibly be, if you're not proud to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, what I suggest to you is open up, reach out. I don't care who it's to. Don't miss this sucker. We only go around one time. Thanks.